Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Night Shadows. I'm Stuart Best, where the paranormal is normal, where that which you thought you knew, you didn't, and where the future can be known if you know exactly where to look.
Well, good evening, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and tonight we have special guest Stan Dale with us. He's got something he wants to tell everyone, and with the, the climate that we're kind of falling into with the threats and counter-threats with Kim in North Korea, Trump here in America, I think we better really listen carefully to what Stan has to say. And we also have Larry with us. Hi, Stan. How are you doing?
Oh, good, good. Had a busy day stretching antennas out the back, getting ready for another test.
Well, good.
And that's in 30 mile an hour.
How are you doing on your mountaintop?
Well,
I'm still here. Go ahead, Stan.
No, sorry, I misunderstood. He was talking to you on your mountaintop. I got a kind of a flat mountaintop. I thought that's what I'm talking about. Okay, go on, yeah.
I think it's a good thing to be maybe on a mountaintop in some ways with what's coming. Stan, tell us about this EMP shield. What would you really call that? Are these
just an EMP shield? They're normally called a surge protector for lightning strikes that might hit near your property and hit your electricity somewhere, and a normal surge protector will take that spark that comes in from the lightning, and unless it's a direct hit on your house, it's the lightning can, put spikes into your computers and various electronics and ruin them. But normally that doesn't happen. But those kind of surge suppressors are slow reacting, and you need things that are down in the 25 picosecond range. I mean, to really respond quickly when you have an EMP pulse from a nuclear bomb. Most people thought that, like myself, that when you have a atomic bomb go off that's wired to make an electromagnetic pulse, that you get one pulse and that, will zap stuff that is not protected. But I found out by reading the papers, a study in detail made by Jerry Emanuelson up here in Colorado Springs. And if you go to my show images page, down the third row, there's pictures 40, 41, and 42, all linking to his site in various places, and 41 is really kind of interesting because it tells about the EMP myths and how they aren't true. And one thing that really surprised me was that in an EMP pulse from a nuclear bomb, there are three pulses, pulse one, event one, event two, event three. Now, event one is that the one if you have a long enough wire or conductor that it will carry the signal into your electronics or, sometimes boats or aircraft and things like that, but very rarely. And but it's that high-speed thing that happens in 25 billionths, of a second. And you have to have a surge protector that will realize that and immediately take that surge and put it into your ground rod that's connected to all your electricity in your house and bypass all of your wiring and hence all of your computers and things inside the house plugged in. Now, there's a second pulse that follows. It's a longer duration, relatively speaking, in microseconds, not as bad. Mm-hmm. And then there's a third one that lasts minutes and sometimes several minutes long. And that's more like an EMP pulse you get from the sun. And that's not so damaging. It will hit the grid and cause transformers to short and stuff like that, but it's not likely to ruin your electronics. But what really, really amazed me was that the majority of cars, even modern cars, if the EMP1 thing goes off, it may cause your car to stop. You just turn the key and start it up again and drive on down the street. A small percentage of cars will be damaged, but the majority of them won't. And so you don't have to have one of those 1970s vehicles to try to weather an EMP attack. And here's another thing. Sorry, what? Yeah, you probably won't have any gasoline for it if they aren't pumping it, but, you know.
Yeah, that's probably true.
This can be avoided by using three-phase EMP pulse protectors or surge protectors. That's what my associate over in Kansas is making. He's invented it, and it will work on two-phase households up to 10,000 square feet area, you know, for wiring and stuff, and it'll work on businesses in a three-phase form. The things are, you know, like under $500, depending whether you get the business one or the cheaper one for the home. But mm-hmm. it protects your whole house. But what I was going to say is that if we have an attack, you know, like Larry's missiles of October, and it hits a bunch of cities or over the top of them and puts all these E1 pulses out there, EMP pulses from the bomb, the first mm-hmm. pulse comes out, and that's the only one you got to worry about, because this guy shows in documented stuff that when that first one goes off, it conditions or ionizes the atmosphere, and so the second, third, fourth, and fifth ones over the next few minutes don't send a spike to you because it broadcasts out through the ionized atmosphere and doesn't cause that sharp ringing pulse along the wires and things that take power to your house. He's looking at protecting aircraft on the ground and in mm-hmm. the air, and marine craft running on, you know, generators and diesel batteries and things like that. So there's a lot to learn in his paper here, and it's written for you to understand. Some of it's a little technical, but you got to have a bit of that to be accurate. So mm-hmm. go to that show images page and look at click on slides 40, 41, and 42, and go and download. You can download his stuff. He's got PDF files out the wazoo that you can study in your own time. I've got them printed out here, probably about a 2-inch thick stack. And it's all the stuff you need to do to prepare for the EMPs. But he didn't have a device that would protect your household like this, or your car, your boat, more than once. Because the one the military uses is fast enough, but the great majority of those, one hit, one EMP, will burn out the certain component called an MOV, metal oxide varistor. Anyway, it'll burn that out. And so you don't have protection a few hours later if there's another EMP nuclear detonation. With what my partner Tim has developed, you can have up to 300 EMPs before it wears out. So it's fast enough. He's got the same speed that the military ones, but he's got a clever way in the circuit design to keep it going and not burn out. And that's the main thing that's really unique about this, especially at such a low price. Anyway, we're going to have the website up, I think he said, by the 20th of October, and we're going to be sending out information to several hundred people here that have already written in and said, let me know when it's available, you know, and tell me how to use it, that kind of stuff. And, you know, the thing is only about the size of, you know, a butter dish, you know, a square butter dish, and it hooks across a circuit breaker in your house out there in the circuit breaker box. Anything that has a circuit breaker of 20 amps or better, like for a freezer or air conditioner, it hooks two wires across that and one to the ground rail. And if you're not an electrician, just have the local electrician come out. It's you know, he's going to screw a white box into the wall, that, you know, that little butter size dish size, and connect mm-hmm. three wires into the thing. Might be a 30-minute job if he takes a smoke break, you know, in the installation. So it's not a big deal, but you should do it safely. And once it's in, your house is good.
Oh, great. What's your take on this satellite up there that comes over across North America? Some people are saying it's already an EMP device, but who knows?
Oh, you mean North Korea stuff?
Yes. Yes.
It depends on the altitude. I don't remember what altitude they said it was. Is it a low altitude? Must be probably a few hundred miles up, is it?
Yes.
Yeah,
that's what they're worried about.
Yeah, it could release. And, you know, a lady wrote in to me about 10 years ago. She had a vision from the Lord, and she said that he showed her that there would be a device at the time that the church needs it that would come out to protect households from EMP attacks. And that's been invented by Tim. You know, I just find it amazing. So, anyway, yeah. The people that have got that will be able to, you know, have computers and electronic stuff continue working on the other side. They will have to have power, So if the grid has been damaged, it might be a few months or a few weeks, whatever, to repair the grid. But there are, I'll tell you this right now, they're already hardening the grid without telling everybody how and when and what ones are protected. So they are doing, you know, very quietly what needs to be done to protect against, you know, Crazy Kim or Rocket Boy doing something to our grid. So if you're a household that needs to have power to, you know, to save freezer and fridge stuff and things like that, and communications, you may need to get a gas or diesel generator. Diesel generators will last longer as far as parts wear. Gasoline ones are higher speed and higher temperature, and they wear out very quickly. And in fact, most of these household generators, around 5 kilowatts that you get, are not like lifetime power supplies. They will burn out. They wear out very quickly, within a year or less. So understand those are temporary things, and that's why we're working on our next phase, which is this antenna system that draws electricity out of the atmosphere with a wire. Probably at this point in time, it's about, just looking out there, about 50 foot long, up between two poles so that you can, you know, get the Army surplus. And that device will then collect energy from the atmosphere and bring it down in a form that you can use it to power your house, and that works day and night. Right now, we've got three test sites going to figure out the right length, the right height off of the ground, a number of other things that are technical, but because this collects high voltage, like 20,000 volts, it's enough to kill you, we're trying to figure out ways to be sure that people, when they put them in, you know, do it safely. We're not going to be able to install these for everybody, so we're going to be teaching people how to do it and selling them the components and give them circuits. Patents have already been started in the process to keep us from being sued, but basically we're going to be quite open and supply stuff and let people put them together, you know, with their neighborhood ham radio guy to help them or something. We're hoping, get this, we're hoping that we can put all this, the wire and everything, the antenna, in a plastic case, like a tube, under the ground so you can't even see it. And that would be beautiful if we can get that to work.
Yeah. Wow. Larry, you got any questions?
Yeah, I was going to ask Stan, I had heard a number of people a few years ago talking about your microwave ovens that burn out or are not working anymore, that those would make a good Faraday cage for electronic equipment, walkie-talkies, et cetera, or radios, hand radios and such, to keep them safe.
You know, they would, but a lot of these things inside with the, you know, just a short antenna, not like a wire antenna, a lot of these will be too short of a wire length to collect the EMP pulse and damage equipment. Now, ham operators with a longer wire outside, you know, up vertical or horizontal or however they have it, they are more at risk, and they will need one of these EMP shields we're talking about to be between their radio equipment and their antenna to throw that burst of energy into the ground instead of letting it get into their ham radios. Most of these guys are, well, at least half of them, I think, would know how to do that anyway, up to the point of getting that fast release shield that we've designed, or that Tim has designed. But you're going to be surprised how many things will survive these EMP attacks. And I tell you, just go to this guy's website. It's if you can't see it on my if you can't look at it on the show images page here, I'm just going to click on it and tell you. His website is called Future Science. That's all one word, futurescience.com. And you get on there and click on the EMP section and just go to town. It'll relieve your mind a lot just seeing how many things won't even need protection, like the cars and stuff.
Yeah. Wow. And I was going to tell you, Stan.
Say again?
Yeah, I was just going to tell you, Stan, that up in the area of Oklahoma where I'm at, and, of course, you're from Dallas originally, and so you know this area, up in these mountains, so we've been having an emergency management meetings tied in with FEMA, and they've been building and working a network of hams and emergency equipment and operators, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, for months now. They're preparing for the type of disaster or event you're talking about, whether it's a sun or whether it's a nuke, they're preparing for those already.
That's called part of the MARS program, and my partner Tim is registered, you know, as part of the participants in that. They've got government clearances, and he can access every frequency, you know, that's known to man for radio because of the clearance level, and they pass information encoded back and forth between people all over the country, and that's our real news gathering network in these times of crisis. And the MARS guys have all got backup generators and stuff, so, you know, it's good to have one on the team.
Yeah, that's what we've got set in up here. Matter of fact, they just put a repeater up here right in almost in my front yard, so I've got the systems repeater that they're using up here. Right, I can use it with a walkie-talkie. So, I got my ham license, by the way, but they are preparing for what's coming.
Yeah, but do you glow at night? That's the real question.
Not yet.
Yeah, I got my license too, Larry, probably about 5 years ago, and I've turned on my handheld thing maybe 5 times since then. Just not enough time to keep up with it.
I know.
So much going on.
Does it make a difference if your car is on or off if you were hit with a very heavy EMP device?
Well,
I mean, if your car was off or your computers were off, does that make any difference, or does it still fry if you're not protected?
It might make a difference in some rare cases, but it's the length of conductor that hooks into, say, the car computer or your computer in the house. And you have to have a fairly good length in most cases of wire, you know, like 50, 60 feet or something like that, to start collecting enough energy to zap your equipment. That's why these EMP shield boxes are so handy. I mean, you know, it'll take all that stuff and eliminate it. Even in the car, I don't think that you're going to have to worry much about it. You've got rubber tires. You've got a metal shell around it. It's like a Faraday cage. And very short wire links inside the, you know, the car in the loom underneath your dashboard. So I, you know, read this guy Emanuelson's papers on this. I mean, he documents the crud out of all this stuff. And you go away and you think, wow, I believe it. You know, it sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's futurescience.com, right?
Yep. Jerry Emanuelson.
It's kind of like a lightning rod that they used to put on barns and houses long ago, and they quit doing that, of course. But is it similar to ground? Is that what this is for?
The ground, your household has a copper bar, hammered into the ground, and then a clip on it that's screwed in, and all of your household electricity has a ground wire, you know, that third plug in your, that third little prong, that goes to the ground. So, you know, you reference normally between your active and your neutral, but that grounds your safety. And so this device is put right next to your circuit breaker box. You drill, in fact, you don't even have to drill but one hole, I think, to put the little three wires, or the thick wires, into the side of the circuit breaker box across the 20 amp or better circuit. And then it's got little LEDs that tell you when it's active and monitoring, and you screw the box into the wall and, you know, you're done.
Huh. Boy, that sounds neat.
I know it sounds simple, but I've gone over the circuit, I've seen the insides of it, and I understand how it works, and it's a clever, clever way to solve the problem.
Huh.
I'm pretty sure at this rate the government's going to want a bunch of this stuff. We could make about 2,000 units a week at the moment. And our first week, when we get into production later in the month, we will probably have all that sold before we even make 2,000 of them. We've got hundreds of inquiries already because it's, you know, it's so low cost and it's so all-encompassing for the house.
Do you have a firm price yet?
We're going to work that out next week. Tim and I are going to get together. It's for the household unit. We're pretty certain it's going to be around the $400 mark. And, you know, there are going to be people reselling it, so there will be some discounts, you know, that will get it down lower than that, I'm sure. But You can go on that as the high price for the household units, and for the corporate ones, it might be close to 600, or you know, because it's three phases. But again, that might even be lower. So we'll have it all firmed up next week. I've started the Excel programs to figure out all the intricacies of that, and as soon as we all decide on it's locked in, then we'll tell everybody on the website and start taking orders.
Oh, great. What's your take on this, if you can stay to talk about it, the massacre out there in Vegas? What's your take on that? Is this the beginning of a domino?
Maybe. What's odd about it is that there's so many reports of other shootings with you know, over the Bellagio and other places that were within a mile and a half of where the massacre occurred, and videotaped on phone. You know, by people that were just civilians at the Bellagio, it tells you that this was an organized effort, not just one guy. And we know that it's heading us toward this gun confiscation, and that will be the thing, I think, that just puts, you know, the spark to make it all happen as far as civil war, you know, insurrection against the government, because they'll be bringing troops to get your weapons like they did down at Katrina, and that's just not going to go down well.
Yeah.
I mean, if you listen
not
to some
well
of the,
all.
If you listen to some of the sounds of the firing of that allegedly one guy, you'll hear some that are weak bursts, you know, off in the distance, and then you hear the pop, 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 the big loud ones close by. So there's a separation. Unless he switched weapons really fast, you know, it was like a second or two. Unless he switched weapons. And one was muffled and one wasn't, you know, then there were at least two sites, maybe three, that you could hear from the sound differences. You know, I think it's going to be a false flag eventually. Doing exactly what you said.
Go ahead.
No, actually, just doing what you said, Stuart.
The Sun, have you got any more information on what's going on? It seems like we're pumping out a few CMEs, and it's gone quiet. Do you think that's going to start like the kill shot routine?
Well, it's possible, because that big coronal hole, which is massive, going from the north to south pole of the sun, it has a 28-day rotation period, and this is supposed to be the low point for sunspot activity, but that's not the be-all, end-all of energy coming from the sun. When you have these large coronal holes, you get super bursts of solar wind, which is proton particles and other particles being shot out. But the one that's pointed at the Earth is the one we've got to worry about it. Now, that's just gone by three days ago, I guess it was. And so from the 3rd of October at 28, you're looking at the end of October, maybe November 2nd or so, it'll be around pointing at us again. And if it continues to grow on the backside, we can tell that with some of the satellites that look behind, the stereo satellites. If it's growing as it goes around the backside, then, you know, you hold your breath as it points at us. The sun is unstable, and the kill shot warning, you know, could very well happen. As I said earlier in the program here, the solar EMPs are not as disastrous as the nuclear ones, because the solar EMPs impulse, you know, the sharpness of it is dull. It's like the level 3 of an EMP series from a bomb. So you can protect against that. It's mainly going to hit the grid and not your household stuff. So that's good news to know, and that's in the Emanuelson papers on that Future Science site.
What's your take on the Isaiah prophecies of the sun becoming seven times brighter and the moon as bright as the sun? Would you classify that as a mini nova, or how would that be classified?
It depends. In the Old Testament, and I think it's in Isaiah, if not in Ezekiel, it says that there will be a cloud form around the sun and diminish its light first, right?
Okay. I think so, yes.
Yeah, and that cloud will obscure the sunlight, and the weakened sunlight with dust in between the sun and the moon will make the light from the moon like the blood color. But then what we think will happen is that the chemistry changing on the sun will throw off a layer of the surface, and that's the dust, and it'll throw it out into the system, into our solar system, and, you know, in a few days it'll be through the system and gone. But the bright light flash will be the detonation, I think, that blows the cloud away. That will be quick. And the side of Earth that's facing the sun at that time, the amount of the area of the Earth that will be struck by this seven times brighter light is only one-third of the area of the Earth. It's not half, it's one-third, because the rest of the rays are too shallow and they go on around us. And that's what will boil the fish in the sea, burn green trees and leaves, and just burn the heck out of that side very quickly. And you can only hope that that's hitting more ocean than land. Now, it will heat up the whole planet because of that. And, you know, we'll certainly have convulsive, catastrophic weather for a while. But that's, I think, how that happens and how people do survive, the light being seven times brighter than it is normally.
Do you think the speed of the Earth changes, the rotational, like the one-third?
I don't know. You know, it might. It might, but it's such a quick burst of light. If the rotation speed changes, it will be because the Earth has heated up and expanded, and the conservation of momentum will mean that as it expands, it starts to slow down. It's like a ballerina. You know, her arms are in close, she spins fast, she puts her arms out, she slows up. So if the planet is heated up by that sudden burst of hot energy from the sun, for a short period of time, it may have, you know, longer days, hopefully.
Well, I can tell that the Earth changes are really accelerating everywhere around the world. I mean, we're just getting hammered left and right. So,
you know, I've put up, what map is it? You know, I had the Hopi map showing how high the water would have to be over on the west side of the United States to put water between the mesas, which their prophecy say will happen. And there was a lady geologist who said to me, she said, look, you could also put water between the mesas of the Hopi by blocking the Colorado River in the Grand Canyon. And there's a one point there where it's very close to a large rock slide that would block the Colorado River and dam that area. And over a few months or years, I did the calculation at one time, it could take as long as 20 years, but probably not. And it would fill up that whole area as a lake, and the water would then be between the mesas. So I redid the map, and I put it at the real heights of if the water level's raised by 200 feet maximum from the melting poles and some of the ice that comes off of the land masses, the areas of the coast of the United States that would be inundated. And then I went a little bit further than that with a lighter kind of blue, which is 200 to 500 feet for you know, surges like from the Canary Islands at Cumbre de Vieja, if that slides down and creates a, you know, a tidal wave, how far inland that would pulse before it then retreated back. So if you go to image 43 and click on that map, and then click on it again once you get it, it's a real high resolution map I made for you, and you can see where you don't want to be living in that event. And interestingly enough, when I did that map, it shows water from Lake Michigan flowing all the way down through the Mississippi and into the Gulf. And part of St. Lawrence as well. And another paper I was reading showed that Lake Michigan, that has that kind of bulgy toe-looking shape to it, that at the bottom part of it next to Chicago there, that's where a comet hit. And they've been mapping out the area with, you know, sensing equipment. And a comet hit there years and years, well, centuries ago, millennia ago. And it provided a lot of the water for the Great Lakes. And, of course, it weakened the crust in that area around that ridge. So earthquakes can occur right around that lower edge when this area is stressed. So there's a lot of things adding up that we're just putting together now, and I put this map up just to show people. It's it'll hit a breadbasket over in the San Joaquin Valley. It'll flood that, just gone, and up into the Baja and the Salton Sea, all these areas have increasing earthquake activity along fault lines that shouldn't be joining that look like they're going to join. So we're approaching some interesting times, as the Chinese say.
Yeah, I would say. And it looks like, you know, with that, was it Chuck Youngbrandt who had that vision, Larry, on the Michigan?
That was Chuck Youngbrandt and another one, I think. There's two of them.
What they
say? They were saying that there would be a huge earthquake, and I know Red Oak said that he saw that, and that Michigan itself will empty into the Gulf, but the water from Superior and the other lakes will be sloshing back and forth because of the power of the earthquake, eventually, of course, totally destroying the middle of the country. Probably part of that land division that the Lord talks about when you split up Jerusalem and Israel, then I'm going to split you guys up. So,
yep.
Makes you wonder.
Well, you know, when the current administration is talking about making that peace treaty over there, it's a worry, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And I think they're very close to it.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, the New Madrid fault zone is really not a fault line. It's a bunch of, like, crystallized, almost like honeycomb vertical structures that formed as that area was stressed in the formation of the North American continent. It was stressed and was going to break and make two separate continents, you know, the East Coast and the West Coast would be separate. But it cooled and left it there. So it's a very brittle, like crystalline structure. And once you hit that, it's going to be a different kind of reaction than one side, sliding over the other. This will be a split and, a deep one. So it's going to be interesting to see what causes that.
Yeah. What's your take? I know I'm holding you up here because I know you wanted
to
leave.
That's all right.
What's your take on this, what's going on in the Middle East? There seems to be a lot of, we know Turkey has to go to the Russian side. They've been sitting on the fence for years. But there's a lot of things seem to be going on over there now that are pointing towards the end of days, for sure.
Well, I think what we're going to see is, like Holly wrote about in Prophetic Perils, is that there will be an Arab consortium that will pull a surprise attack on Israel. That consortium was already formed 2 years ago by Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and he got 34 nations, Arab nations, together, and they've been doing joint military exercises. Their objective is now to start moving their forces to a position in Syria against Iran, and of course that would be against Russia as well at the moment. Prince Salman, I think in the last 2 weeks, had a secret visit over to Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel, saying something, we don't know what, but it seemed like it was happy times, but let's bury the hatchet of thousands of years between the Arab nations and Israel, and let us get up close to you there in Syria near the Golan Heights and attack Iran. Well, we think, from what the scripture said, and Holly's talked about that in the book, that the Arab nations will, under Prince Mohammed bin Salman, will do a left turn at the Golan Heights. I mean, it's like, 5-minute drive down the hill and you're in northern Israel.
Yes.
They'll do a surprise attack on Israel, but Israel's not stupid, and they know this is a possibility, and they have nuclear weapons that are interesting, and they're fiery, hot weapons, and we think this is why a bunch of the invading Arabs will be just melted, destroyed by fire, like in the prophecies, and they will then be defeated and turned back, and Israel will gain more land of its own land that was given in the decree to Abraham. And they'll get all the way down to Riyadh. The northern half of Saudi Arabia will then be occupied by Israel, and that's probably where they'll put the Palestinians.
Oh. Larry.
Yeah, Stan, I was going to ask you. Yeah, I was. Stan, I've been watching really, really close this Mohammed bin Salman. And what is your take? The Saudi king himself, Salman, I guess, is. Father just went to visit Putin in Moscow at the Kremlin for like 3 days now. He's been there, making deals. They're reporting it as dealing about the Iranian situation and oil. What do you think is really going on with that trip?
Well, it might be setting up plans, as I say, to surprise Israel, or think they're going to surprise Israel. There's another invasion, from that Russia will be part of. They're already down the Middle East, but with hooks in their jaws, they will be pulled into an attack on northern Israel. But I think that will be the second one after the failed Prince Salman invasion. So King Salman is on the verge of abdicating and turning everything over to his son, but because we think from the reports that King Salman is starting to go senile a bit. If you'll remember, in the Bible, we talk about King Solomon, David's son, and we say Solomon. But in Hebrew, his name was Shlomo, and that doesn't sound like Solomon at all. When you dig back 200 or 300 years before the Israeli King Solomon was born, the first powerful king in the region, in the Middle East, was Shalmaneser the Great, Shalman the Great. And he formed the Assyrian Empire. He built Asher. And in the Arab legends, he is the King Solomon that they revere. And he actually built a temple to whatever god he worshipped at that time, over near the Golan Heights, kind of east of there a bit. And the footprint of it, I've seen the stones and everything, is almost identical to the one that Shlomo, King Solomon of Israel, built for the temple for God. A strange thing. And so Shlomo's mother changed his name from, Jedediah or whatever, to Shlomo, to bring it closer to the name of her history and of the Assyrians. So she was naming him after a famous king in their history who had a powerful fire weapon and all kinds of stuff. He was really quite revered in the region. So it's in this culture, there's a mix between their Solomon and the Israeli Solomon, and the legends of dealing with the genies and all this kind of, there's a mixture of what's true about the Israeli King Solomon and the Shalmaneser that came a couple of years, 100 years ahead of, or before him, sorry. So it's interesting to study this, because when they had the diaspora and Israel was scattered all over the world, well, of course, things got forgotten or mixed up, and tales were told verbally instead of written down. And so I don't think that King Solomon of the Israelis was flying on a flying carpet and stuff like that, But but they attribute this to the Arabian King Solomon. But and that's when you look at Revelation 13, when it says, "Here's a secret. I'm going to tell you what the name of the Antichrist is." And it's here wisdom is, 666 is the number of the name of the man. Okay, well, in the Bible, it translates itself. You say, where is 666 mentioned? It was what King Solomon of Israel received in talents of gold per year, 666. What is Solomon? The legend of Solomon is that he was the wisest man, in history. So wisdom, here's wisdom, 666, Solomon. And so then you look at the Solomon family that are now in charge of the Arab nations, and there's a very strong possibility they come from a Jewish bloodline that's being debated, and one guy came public with that about 3 years ago, and they locked him up and killed him in Saudi Arabia because of that. But there's a growing discontent with the Solomon family, saying that they're not really Arabs. They're from an Israeli line, a trader line that were with Basra and then moved in and became the powerful Solomon family or dynasty. Anyway, all that stuff, you put that together in your mind, and you think, this is confusing, but it tells you that the name of the first beast, the Antichrist, is most probably Solomon. And this young Prince Solomon, he's gaining the power, and he's not experienced in warfare. He's made mistakes in Yemen, but he's learning, and he's learned how to be cunning and quick, like a tiger. And there's one thing that's not biblical, but I'm going to throw it out there. In the writings of Nostradamus, he says the third, the last Antichrist will be named Mabus, M-A-B-U-S. And in the courthouse, or what do you call it the not a castle, but you know, in the royal buildings there in Saudi Arabia, there are two guys that were vying for control to be the king, and they were cousins. There was Mohammed bin Salman, who was the son of King Salman, and then it was his cousin Mohammed bin Nayef. And so to keep them apart when they were in the hallways yelling for this one or that one to come to a meeting or whatever, they would say, get MBN or get MBS. Well, now, MBS, the young prince, has formed an Arabic Union, AU. Throw that in between MBS and you have Mabus.
Well, wow.
Interesting.
Yeah. With all the stuff that's going on, of course, it can happen overnight or it can take years. I guess that's the problem we have with timing.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is if this, you know, the Antichrist, the first beast, gets wounded and defeated in a battle, you know, if you look at Revelation 13, the preposition for he, we're not sure whether it's he, the first Antichrist, or he, the false prophet that comes after him and reveres him, but in the end of Revelation 13, the second guy does all the numbering and the terrible, nasty stuff. He's more powerful than that. And he comes more out of Turkey region, like Erdogan and that kind of stuff. And Erdogan in Turkey reveres Suleiman the Great in their history. And so he would probably glom on to the hero worship of Mohammed bin Salman, even though he gets beaten. What he did, and then they will have images of him and say, look, this is what started all this, and let's finish it, and let's organize things. And that may be when the peace treaty is made, I don't know. But we see all of this forming, and as fast as things have been happening already, maybe it will be sooner than we thought.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Larry, what do you think?
Yeah, that's interesting. Before we let Stan off the hook here, I would like his opinion. There's been a number of internet YouTubes and reports coming out of the Mississippi River area that they're losing water somewhere. It's going underground, or there's a break somewhere in the bed of the Mississippi, and it appears to be they're showing images of water lossage. What do you think about that situation?
Holly investigated that, and you'll also find that in those areas there's been extreme drought for a long time, and that drought may be drying it up if we're not replenishing it with rain in the area. It doesn't mean that there can't be a subsurface fracture and it's slowly seeping down, but the majority of evidence says it's the drought that's causing that lower, you know, the sandbars to appear. It is certainly affecting traffic up and down the Mississippi. And, you know, not as many heavy loads can get through because they hit the keel on the sandbars that are forming. So, you know, it might be there's something stressing under this. As I said to you before, it's not a fault line. It's a fault zone of these kind of crystallized vertical pipes that they're going to react differently. And if they crack or start to fracture, maybe they're, I don't know where the water would go, you know, to do that, though. It would have to be flowing still down toward the Gulf, I guess. But anyway, I think the preponderance of evidence at the moment is drought. But even drought will cause shrinkage and changes in the surface there. So it might contribute to that. Just keep an eye on it and see what happens.
Well, there is a prophecy against, I think it's in Jeremiah, where it says that the lakes and the rivers and the streams of Babylon will be dried up. So,
yep, and I think we are Babylon of the modern times.
Yeah, so I guess we're going to have to watch and see. Any kind of shift in the weather patterns could, of course, cause all that to take place fairly rapidly, I would think.
What's the story with Hurricane Nate, Holly? Is that intensifying?
Bullseye right on New Orleans.
All right, well, about 1 o'clock. 1 a.m. Saturday night, it should be hitting New Orleans. That's the latest forecast.
Wow.
Yeah. Boy, when it rains, it pours, doesn't it?
Well, it makes you wonder. I mean, we went through our 40 days of repentance, the Jonah symbol, from the eclipse, and there was absolutely no mention of repentance. And so I would think we're probably going to get pounded pretty hard from here on out.
Yeah, Holly said it's 1 a.m. Sunday that Nate's going to hit. But, yeah, I think it's going to intensify. And, you know, they're certainly pushing this, two-state solution, peace treaty between Israel and the Palestinians at the moment. And Lord help us if that happens, because, you know, I'm sure that this country will split right down the middle.
Yeah.
You know,
anything else?
Another thing.
Yeah.
Sorry, go on.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
In that map of the United States where I'm showing the water lines, you'll see the Appalachians looks like a snake trail coming down from, up in Canada nearly, down toward Tennessee. And if you look closely, you'll see a little at the end of the yellow prong coming down toward Mississippi and Tennessee, you'll see a curve of like a crater impulse. And I think there was a dirty big snowball, you know, a comet that hit there and formed all that area. And so where that green arc at the tip of the Appalachians is down toward Mississippi there, where that curved arc is if that's the rim of where it stopped and melted and pushed up the dirt there, it'll be like the El Tanin meteor down south of Argentina. It has earthquakes around the weakened rim. And so this is so close to the Mississippi Valley. You know, this could be a weak spot. And another one, you know, if you look up where the green is at the top of the Mississippi at the moment, kind of curves a little blue line coming up into to Chicago. There is an arc there which could be where the rest of the comet that made Lake Michigan stopped and weakened the crust there. So you've got two ancient possible comet impacts that formed, you know, before we even settled America, obviously a long time ago. But those weak spots are susceptible to earthquakes.
Yeah.
It's the arc.
Well, I know everybody, not everybody, but what prophecies we've had or dream visions that people have had indicate a massive earthquake somewhere in the United States. One says East Coast, some say West Coast. And, of course, we've had a whole bunch of earthquakes along the West Coast now.
Yeah.
That seems to be intensifying.
Yeah, the Juan de Fuca area up in Oregon, Washington State border region there and just offshore is certainly building up pressure. They've known for decades now that that's going to eventually release with about a 9 to 9.5 Richter earthquake, which won't be good for the West Coast, the North part of it anyway. And if it triggers the San Andreas fault and the parallel fault to that, you know, like the Rose Canyon fault, that would hit a lot of the cities down along the West Coast all the way to the Baja. So that certainly could be where it occurs. But as far as dividing the country, my bet would be on the Lake Michigan, New Madrid area for a big one. And that, too, could trigger the West Coast, the Juan de Fuca thing, so we could have two divisions.
Well, I know David Wilkinson and his vision that he had. He said this earthquake was so large. I mean, it was worldwide news for weeks. And that would tend to indicate what you just said, that it's probably going to be in the middle of the country in a place. He said it was a place he thought not known necessarily for quakes.
Right. Well, that would be there. And that would certainly divide the east from the west, and our power, you know, our food supplies coming from the Midwest wouldn't reach the majority of our population on the east coast, on the eastern side of that break. So,
well,
yeah.
That wouldn't that just about sever the gas lines, the oil lines, and any ability to travel?
Yep. You'd have to fly
back and forth,
and that would be very expensive.
So that would be devastating to the United States. And it almost appears as though the Lord is hitting America in places where where he's just kind of chipping away at our economy and possibly even our food supplies.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, Florida produces food, and California does for sure. Houston is refineries, and you got them up into Louisiana as well and offshore. There's more to come, I'm sure, but food and water are pretty important, and then next comes power, which is really more important than all of that, because you can make fresh water from seawater if you got power, but if the grid is hit by something as well, we've got a real problem.
Larry, any
Stan,
for the whole hour. We baited him.
Yeah, I know we did. Stan, I appreciate you coming on, and hey, give a shout-out also to Holly, because I heard her in the background, and you guys are doing a phenomenal job. I go to your site every day, and I'm shocked. I don't know how many hours you guys put in, but it's a lot.
Well,
and,
Holly,
I wanted to ask you, though, we've had a lot of really anomalous earthquake activity in Oklahoma recently, and it's really kind of all the middle of Oklahoma up to the north and a little bit in the east and a little bit in the northwest. You think that's a little bit connected in with the New Madrid to some degree, or is that its own fault,
again,
maybe?
Yeah, I do. Look at the map I showed you there with the water rivers, you know, and stuff. Those rivers are depressions in, you know, weaknesses in the surface where these faults, produce earthquakes. And you'll see, it'd be up above Louisiana in Arkansas, there is a horizontal blue band. You can see of rivers heading over toward Oklahoma. And that could certainly be affecting the increase in earthquakes there, in addition, of course, to the backfilling of the gas wells and things like that. But between that and this fault line running sideways, you'll see that it goes right through Oklahoma and heads over toward Arizona or New Mexico, I guess. I don't have the map lines, the state lines on it. I'm just looking at that map like you are. But you can see that yellow weakness running clear across there. So the Oklahoma quakes are right at the top of this, a yellow line. You can see it, running across Oklahoma there. And that's where all these small earthquakes are intensifying. There's another area up, at Soda Creek, up in the northwest, Idaho, which is sort of connected on the periphery of the ancient borders to the Yellowstone caldera in the ancient times when it first started erupting. So that's been quite active, and there is a line there you can see if you zoom over to the mountains there that has a lot of earthquakes running all the way down to the Baja periodically and up into Washington State near St. Helens and stuff like that. So the whole country is experiencing some very interesting kind of precursor quakes, I think, to some big release somewhere.
I want to read something and get a comment from you, Stan, as long as you're with us. It's from the Book of Enoch, and
right.
It says, in the days of sinners, the years shall be shortened. The seed shall be backward in their prolific soil, and everything done on earth shall be subverted and disappear in its season. The rain shall be restrained, and heaven shall stand still. In those days, the fruit of the earth shall be late and not flourish in their season, and in their season the fruits of the trees shall be withholden. The moon will change its laws and not be seen at its proper period. And in those days shall heaven be seen, and barrenness shall take place in the borders of the great chariots of the west. I think that's America, don't you think? Maybe? We're the great chariots, and it's mentioned in Jeremiah and Isaiah, land of the chariots.
Well, it's possible. We certainly have a lot of those four-wheel things driving across the country.
What do you think about this thing about the not only the drought, but the changing of the seasons? It almost appears as that's beginning already.
Oh, yeah. The last 2 years we've seen it in our own orchard. And in the garden, the raised gardens that Holly has out there, our orchard is not producing well, and spring before last, we have what's called sunburn or sunburst on the south side of our trees, and we lost half of the trees in the orchard because it just cooked the bark. It had a false spring, then it cooled, and then put ice in there, and then another sunburst, and it just exploded the bark off and just unwrapped it like a scroll. And it wasn't just our orchard. A lot of the trees here in Pueblo, in the area where we are, had the same mm-hmm. problem. And then this year, we got, I know trees take a holiday normally, but we got no peaches at all, no cherries, well, a couple of little tiny ones, no plums. Apples were, we had three or four apples on one of the trees. So wow. we're seeing, you know, changes in the fruit. And we had plenty of bees. I mean, everybody else may be complaining about the shortness of bees, but we had tons of them here. So they had, we had pollinators here, but just not enough pollen.
Wow. What do you make of this comment that the days of the sinners, the years, shall be shortened? Now, we know they were 360-day years, then all of a sudden it went to 365. Some have said that's because of something that came by, a space object of some sort. What's your take? Could this happen again, and we go back to a 360-day year, literally?
Well, that would speed up the spin of the Earth. And to do that, we would have to actually contract the Earth's diameter back again, like the ballerina. If she pulls her arms in, she spins faster.
Mm-hmm.
I had never thought about the Earth actually reducing its diameter after having expanded to, you know, it used to be 25% smaller before the Great Flood, when we had an asteroid, maybe two asteroid impacts that caused the Great Flood. And mm-hmm. that broke up Pangaea eventually, and the diameter of the Earth expanded. You know, the ridge lines that we see in the Atlantic Ocean. But what would make it collapse back, I'd have to give thought to that, because I don't know what would do that, unless there was some kind of a shell collapse underneath the Earth. You know, I don't know. I'd have to give that some thought. That's an interesting question. But that's, unless there's some kind of a big, oh, well, Revelation says there's going to be a star fall in the, a burning star, like, fall into the ocean. And
yep.
that impact, if it's in the direction of spin from, you know, west to east, then it could add energy to the planet. That would be a mighty strike to do that, though. It has to strike the surface of the Earth and not move the whole inside of the Earth, because the mass of the Earth is so big that, you know, that wouldn't happen unless it was a planet killer. But if an asteroid hits...
Skip.
Yeah, a shallow skip, and the thin crust of the Earth can actually be moved, like on magma bearings, mm-hmm. moved further and faster than the rest of the planet underneath. The Egyptian records and the Chinese records show that the sun has risen in the west twice before, and in mm-hmm. The east, and we're in the second east rising, which meant that the mantle, the surface of the Earth, when it was younger, and that the molten, the heat underneath the cratons that formed the continents, it would slide easier, and so it flipped the Earth's surface upside down, not the whole Earth. And this is where, you know, the mainstream scientists, the arguments they give, say, "Oh, this, it takes so much energy to spin the whole Earth," but they don't think mm-hmm. about that thin skin. It's what's being moved, and that's why Atlantis, or where Noah was a citizen, why they look for that in the Atlantic Ocean instead of to the west in the when the Earth was upside down in Turkey and Syria border there at the port of Antioch. I see we're getting close to run out of time.
Huh. Yep. Okay. Well, Stan, I didn't mean to hold on to you for the full hour, but I'm happy that you did. We
Fair
thank
enough.
You for that.
Well,
Larry, you got any one final comment? We got about.
Oh no, I just appreciate Stan so much. Is there anything he wants to leave us with?
Well, certainly it's a time if you've got family members and friends that are on the fence about joining the Lord's team, it might be a good time to kind of put evidence before them from the various websites that have and books that have information about how close we are to this, and maybe you'll save some of them.
Well, very good. Well, thanks, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Stan, for coming on. Thanks, Larry, for coming on. And we'll see you next week if the Lord is willing, and we certainly hope he is. So good night, everyone.
Amen.